Discourse on Habeas Corpus by Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom. Episode 7. Chicanery, Deceit, and Circumvention. Before we move on to the apparent effect of the 14th Amendment on the people of the United States, or some of the people of the United States, I did say apparent effect. It's important to understand the concept of standing in court. Standing in court is, do you have a right to be in that court? Are you in the proper court? When we go back to Baron Abelman v. Booth and Henry Tarbell, for example, we see that Wisconsin assumed something. The United States had jurisdiction because of the constitutional access. We saw that the voting decision in the 15th Amendment case, it was left to the state court. Their ruling was fine because the authority of Sections 3 and 4 didn't extend. We also saw in Henry Lane the matter of jurisdiction and standing. He wanted to go under Lane wanted to go under Kansas law, and instead, jurisdictionally, he had standing only in the federal court. Now, here's one of standing that's rather interesting, and you've probably heard about the case before, but there are some very insightful things in Dred Scott v. Sanford. It was ruled on by Justice Taney. It's at 60 U.S. 393. That's 60 U.S. 393, and it was heard in 1856, before the Civil War. It had to do with a slave who had been mistreated by Sanford, his owner. Dred Scott was the slave. The courts didn't allow a Negro to testify against a white man at that time or sit on a jury. That was the law at the time. They also couldn't bring an action. Now, what happened is the lower court had ruled against Dred Scott, so he took the United States Supreme Court. And in Taney's decision, here's what he said. The plea denies the right of the plaintiff to sue in a court of the United States for the reasons therein stated. If the question raised by it is legally before us, and the court should be of opinion that the facts stated in it disqualify the plaintiff, which is Scott, from becoming a citizen in the sense in which that word is used in the Constitution of the United States, then the judgment of the circuit court is erroneous and must be reversed. It is suggested, however, that this plea is not before us, and that as a judgment in the court below on this plea was in favor of the plaintiff, he does not seek to reverse it, who was Sanford at that time, or bring it before the court for revision by this writ of error, and also that the defendant waived this defense by pleading over and thereby admitted jurisdiction of the court. So what we have here is Dred Scott took it to the Supreme Court. Sanford did not object timely to the fact that Dred Scott had no right to take it before that court. So the court said the defendant, Sanford, waived his defense by pleading over. So when he pled, answered the charges brought by Sanford to the Supreme Court, he pled over and thereby admitted jurisdiction of the court. So the court didn't have jurisdiction. Sanford didn't object timely. He brought up the objection later, but it wasn't timely. The court decided to hear it because the matter of jurisdiction was not brought to the attention of the court before the court began hearing the case. It was brought later. So, interestingly, standing can be created by failure to object timely. Now, keep that in mind as we go on. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified. Now, the story of its ratification is covered in a different article of mine on the 14th Amendment. But for the sake of this current discussion, the only thing significant is the first few phrases of it. Section 1 says that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. Boy, that one phrase, that little catcher in there, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Well, we've determined by Barron versus Baltimore that the federal government did not have jurisdiction over a matter of taking of property. We determined that in 1825, the court to have jurisdiction, or the government to have jurisdiction over people who damaged government property on ceded land, that it had to be ceded and jurisdiction ceded. So there was no jurisdiction over somebody that damaged government property that wasn't on government property ceded with jurisdiction. By Abelman and Tarple, we see that jurisdiction exists when a nexus is created by the Constitution. So when the 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized, we can't assume that all persons born or naturalized come under federal jurisdiction. Oh, well, if they're naturalized, definitely they are, because the United States has naturalized them. But the qualifier, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So the question arises, did that make white people state citizens within the United States in 1868 who were not subject to the jurisdiction of, as we've explained, 14th Amendment citizens or citizens of the United States? Now, a little further on, we'll discuss a case where the same court, 40 years later, makes abundantly clear that there are two classes of citizens in this country, but we'll go on with the 14th Amendment now. What they did create, the ones they had jurisdiction over, were those that were not allowed citizenship, and I don't believe any state really granted citizenship to a Negro. They weren't allowed citizenship, so they're guests in the country. They're not protected by the Constitution, as was explained in Dred Scott v. Sanford. Visitors, foreigners coming into this country, and in the 14th Amendment article, I go into detail in the Congressional Record and what they talked about, but they talked about Chinamen, Indian, Italians, not Italians, I'm sorry, take that back. They talked about these other people from around the world, including Indians, and they had to set a distinction on Indians, which ones were and which ones were not, but they never mentioned white people. As strange as it seems, they never mentioned white people. So they didn't perceive in those discussions on the 14th Amendment that people that were citizens of a state by virtue of the state laws and no federal law regarding jurisdiction or citizenship actually existed. It was pretty much recognized if they were citizens of one of the states united under and by the Constitution, they were citizens of the United States until the 14th Amendment. So those who were citizens of a state under a member of the Union under and by the Constitution were not subject to the jurisdiction of, and therefore were not affected by the 14th Amendment. So is there proof that that, let's call it a thesis. This is a thesis that white citizens of the states were not affected. They were not subject to jurisdiction, therefore did not become 14th Amendment citizens. That's a thesis. Let's see if the court will shed some light on this and make this a valid premise. In 1908, Albert C. Twining and David C. Cornell were convicted of providing false papers to the state banking examiner in New Jersey. They were sentenced to prison, and Twining appealed to the United States Supreme Court based upon his Fourth Amendment rights. He argued that the requirement to turn over papers to the examiner, absent a court order, denied him due process clause under the 14th Amendment. Twining and Cornell were both citizens of New Jersey, and white. Since they were citizens of New Jersey, the state, they were not within the jurisdiction of the court. Therefore, the court had no jurisdiction. And here's what the court said. It was Justice Moody. providing the decision. The decision, as I said, 1908. The case is Twining, T-W-I-N-I-N-G, versus State of New Jersey. It's at 211 U.S. 78. That's 211 U.S. 78. In order to bring themselves within the protection of the Constitution, it is incumbent upon the defendants to prove two propositions. First, that the exemption from compulsory self-incrimination is guaranteed by the federal Constitution against impairment by the states. And second, if it be so guaranteed, that the exemption was in fact impaired in the case at bar. Now, due process was extended by the 14th Amendment. So the first proposition naturally presents itself for earlier consideration. If the right here asserted is not federal right, that is the end of the case. We have no authority to go further and determine whether the state court has erred in the interpretation of the enforcement of its own laws. So, well, it doesn't apply. Due process was not extended to the state citizens by the 14th Amendment. We do not pass upon the conflict because for the reason given, we think that the exemption from compulsory self-incrimination in the courts of the states is not secured by any part of the federal constitution. Now, if they were 14th Amendment citizens, it had been established that those rights of due process were guaranteed to the citizens. So the conclusion can only be that a state citizen is not subject to federal jurisdiction. So where do we go from here? We've got a kind of an interesting scenario where some people aren't subject to federal jurisdiction and some are, both in subject matter, in personam, which is the individuals, which is the two classes of citizen, and in venue, which is back to where the spheres of government cannot overlap. They have to comfortably work between themselves, which was the Henry Lane case. So we'll continue this in the next episode.